why it may be a good thing to be a little out of control today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So, in having this conversation, I have run into several occasions recently where the practical difference between, I'm about to introduce a philosophical term, I will not just be living in it today, but hang with me, a couple of terms, the practical difference between empiricism and rationalism. I have seen the difference in the way things are planned or the way they're taught or the way they're comprehended, and even in the way we look as a society at our problems and try to solve them, and try to solve them in different ways. The difference is very often whether we're being rationalistic or empirical about how we're coming at it. And I realize these terms have a variety of meanings in different contexts, so I want to give a little context to the difference, but then the focus is just on a favor or prejudice that I've developed toward a more empirical approach to problem solving, a more empirical approach to just doing a lot of the practical things we do in life. But I want to explain what I mean by that. And so I'm intent, I'm sort of lecturing myself right now, this moment, on not doing this. I am intent on not spending the whole time speaking about these ideas philosophically. You know the difference, probably, empiricism and rationalism, the ways we talk about human beings gaining knowledge philosophically. It's in the discipline of epistemology. I don't care about that. The point is that a more empirical approach, empiricism itself, has these certain characteristics to it, that it's based on experience and observation, and that our knowledge has a lot to do with being shaped by that. Obviously, in the philosophical sense, all knowledge begins with experience, if you're an empiricist. But it has certain forms. So if you're inclined in that direction, and our entire culture is inclined in this direction, America is an empirical country, an empirical culture. It's just built into us. Even those of us who don't want to be that or have chosen not to be that, we are that in our basic cultural understanding. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to argue that point today, although I just did. I just want to make the point that it's natural for us to be that. That's not what this is really about. It's about more of the method that comes when you think more empirically or more based on the experience of the moment and contingencies, that you think differently about how to solve problems. And so some of the forms that takes in our culture, in our experience, are science, for instance. Just the fact that instead of getting in a dark closet and closing our eyes and thinking, what should this solution be like? We instead put on a lab coat and go into a laboratory and take lab equipment, a lot of lab in there, and do experiments and then see what works and doesn't work. And when we finally come on something that works, even if we don't really understand fully why it's working, we use that to help us find the solution, which explains why it not only takes the form of science in our culture, but also pragmatism, that whatever works, that must be the right thing to do. So businesses are not evaluated on whether they have, and when we try to insert something like this on them, we don't like it. Businesses are not evaluated on whether they have the right value set, on whether they have the right mission statement. Businesses are evaluated on how much money they make. Did it work? Did it get the dollars in the door? You know, that's the only thing that really matters. that's a pragmatic approach to problem solving, or to understanding what's right and wrong, or to understanding what's valuable or not valuable. When you as a culture can think to yourselves, you know, whatever works is what's true, or whatever works is the right thing to do, then you know that you're a pragmatic culture. So anyway, we are, and we're proudly pragmatic. I mean, pragmatism as a philosophical approach to life comes from American influences. C.S. Pierce and William James, Dewey, the names that we associate with pragmatism are American names. Anyway, it's the forms that a lot of our empiricism takes in our culture: science, pragmatism, and then last, existentialism. It's not the same as empiricism, but it's an outflow of it, and it naturally follows from it and all the isolation that goes with it. I'm not going to try to get into existentialism today, but it is a part of the world that we're in because we're in an empirical world. But that's not my point. The point today is that there are certain implications of looking at the world through an empirical lens, through the lens of empiricism, even if you don't know you're doing it. It doesn't matter that you call yourself an empiricist or you've never heard the word before. If your world is based on the experiences you have and the feedback you get from the attempts you make to adjust that experience, and then you use that feedback as a way of determining what the best action forward is, you just have this sort of pragmatic approach to life, in other words. It has certain implications for how we solve problems. And one of those implications, the one that I really want to focus on today, is decentralization, meaning we don't think to ourselves, ooh, I need to get back to the origins of all thought, figure out that kernel to truth that we all adhere to, and then reapply that to the world to get it back under control. That's not the way we approach things. Instead, we use this decentralized problem-solving strategy. As an example, when we want to learn things, if we're more empirical in our approach, then we use, you know, what amounts to, for people who are philosophically inclined, you'll know what I mean when I say the tabula rasa. The idea is that the mind at birth is a blank slate, and that it's only experience that begins to form the structures of the mind into the thing that we have as adults so that we can use it for, you know, all the stuff that we do. But I want to use that phrase, the tabula rasa, the blank slate, to make the point that in learning, when you're making observations and coming to know things, you use a sort of tabula rasa approach to finding the answer to things. With my students, when I'm trying to get them to understand the difference between a rationalist and empiricist approach to sociology, for instance, I always make the point that if you're an empiricist, you would go to a different culture as a sociologist. You would go to a different society, and you wouldn't take with you a list of the expected outcomes that you have in mind or a list of the specific categories of understanding that you need to gain in order to make your claims about sociology. You'd take a blank tablet with you, and you would then start collecting data and information and then start allowing the data, as bare as it could be, of course, it's never completely bare, to coalesce into categories and ideas that you can then begin to use to give some summary to the sociological structures of that society, whatever. So in learning, you would take a decentralized approach if you were more of an empiricist. In planning, it would be the same way. This term that came from, I think, the president or CEO of Visa a long time ago, or MasterCard or somebody like that, the term chaotic is a way of understanding this. A chaotic, you know, not chaotic completely, but some kind of blend of chaos, but also with order that's imposed on it, or at least sort of naturally emerges from it. That chaotic approach to problem solving in an empiricist perspective is better than a constrained one. And the reason for it is simple, and this is an important part of what I want to talk about today altogether. The reason it's a better solution, a better way to find solutions than a constrained sort of top-down governed approach to finding solutions is because it's open to a creativity that the other can't even see. And it may be that in that less organized, less controlled approach to solving problems, you run across 11 really bad ideas, or 11 tries that just fail over and over again, or 11 outcomes that are not so great. In order to find the one that's good. But it also means that, you know, that one might be a thousand times better than the others. And once found, the great value to it is it's boundless. Its value goes on for as long as you choose to use it into the future. And so you can imagine why it kind of makes sense to leave a door open to creativity that you might not sense otherwise. If you look on the opposite side of the spectrum from empiricism, you'd have rationalism, again, not as a philosophical idea, but, you know, based on that philosophical understanding, but just the way people think about the world and solving problems. The characteristics of it are that it is synthetic. It looks at things from the perspective of someone who already has a sense of what the outcomes ought to be. This is how we solve problems. It's five steps and you're done. You first look at this and this is the ontological reality behind it, and that's all we have to deal with. And the forms that kind of approach would take in our society over time, and again, this is not mostly true of American society to begin with because we're sort of naturally empirical in our way of doing things, but it would always have this I can talk about this in a sense because I'm in a theological setting. Criswell College is, you know, we have a liberal arts curriculum, but with a Bible curriculum as well. All of our students get a Bible and theology degree. So it's, you know, a little flavor of an undergraduate seminary or something like that, but with some other degrees, education, PPE, psychology, stuff like that. So we have a pretty broad spectrum of things that we cover, but also we're rooted in, you know, theology and scripture and our commitment to Christ. And so those things are less empirical. They do require a more rationalist approach. And so I actually get to see some of this stuff. So the form that a rationalist approach to problem solving takes is that you'll have theoretical speculation, like it's fine. Close your eyes and think hard and creatively and come up with answers no one else has come up with. That's all fine. But you do it also with some authority. And I mean in both directions. You have an authority over you that restrains you. Well, you can't get outside these bounds because this is the limitation within which we think, which is a good thing. You know, you need that on some of these items, like doctrine, for example. But also an authority from the person who's speculating. Well, I can say this with authority because we know these five things are true from the history of the world. It also takes the form of a lot of certainty, where empiricism always has this little bit of doubt or skepticism built into it. It has a little acknowledgement of imperfection built into it. Rationalism can very often wind up, and for good cause, it can wind up in places where you just say, it can't be other than this. I teach a course in logic. There are things about which you have to say, it can't be other than this. It's necessarily true. So I'm not disdaining certainty. I'm just saying rationalism has an inclination toward things that are certain. When you're defining concepts, you're going to come up with definite answers. You know, the definitions are not going to be, this is what we think it might be. You're going to end up being like a Kant. No, it's not a hypothetical imperative. It's not a sociological imperative or a cultural imperative. It's a categorical imperative. It could not possibly be other than what it is. And if I sound like I'm mocking him, I am a Kantian ethicist. I buy his argument on ethics. I think the absolutes for us are in those areas of truth and beauty and justice, meaning ethics. Truth, obviously, aesthetics. I mean, beauty, obviously, aesthetics. But truth, beauty, and all of those kinds of, they're not abstract, they're real. They're not concrete either, though. They're not something you can put your hand on and have an experiment with. You're thinking about them. In that world, I think it makes sense to take something of a Kantian approach. Doesn't matter if you know what that is, Kantian approach. You've got enough of it just from the fact I'm saying. When Kant defines ethics, I mean, it's done. If you don't agree with him, it's just because you don't understand ethics yet. That's the only thing it could be. Even in defending my dissertation, I remember having talked about how different cultures have different expressions of morality. And so I used the word moralities. So they have these moralities, those have that those moralities. And I mean, my whole dissertation was about making the point that there is an absolute morality. So I'm not at all loosey-goosey on my understanding of morality. But I mean, one of the professors who was a Kantian expert, he's like, that word doesn't even mean anything. Morality, there's only one morality, the categorical imperative. That's all it can possibly be. It was a very Kantian response from someone who's not a pure rationalist, by the way. Anyway, the point is, on defining concepts, you can end up with a level of certainty that seems, a little rigid. But it might be necessary to accept it and to recognize it. The form it might take of certainty, that is, in a rationalist approach to things, the form that might take on things that are not completely within the mind, like 2 + 2 = 4, you can be pretty certain about. But things instead that might be historical, like, what's the political path that nations are going to go down? You understand the difference when you take a rationalist approach if you hear someone like Plato describing the inevitable path that a society is going to go down with its political structures. I mean, you're, after all, going to develop, and I could take a day talking about this, but I'm just going to run through it real quickly. So if you don't know all the phrases, don't worry about it. That's not the point. You start out with this society that becomes pretty healthy and full, plenty of grain, and we're building houses, and we got furniture, and man, the water's flowing, things are all comfortable. It's Kallipolis, a healthy city, a kind of whole city is the idea in Plato's Republic I'm talking about. And then but then what he goes on to do is establish this pattern that societies are inevitably going to follow, and it's clear that he believes he's able to look back and see how history has developed that way, but that it's not based on his observations of history. It's based on the way things would have to unfold. I mean, you're going to go from a pretty well-functioning society to one that's ruled by those who receive the most honor, which seems obvious. I mean, they're the ones who are going to rise to the top, right? So you end up with a timocracy and then an oligarchy, because over time, timocracy, they're rising to the top, they're getting the most wealth, but generation after generation, not everybody's of the same honor. And so eventually it becomes about who has the most money, who has the most land, and an oligarchy takes over. And then that leads to two different societies. And so you have all the haves and all the have-nots. And eventually, by definition, the have-nots are more, and they realize they've got more power. And so they overthrow the oligarchy, and you end up with a democracy through the process of revolution. And then if you have a democracy, the people who are going to be elected into power have to eventually be doing it of their own free will, which means the people who are in charge are the people who want to be in charge, which doesn't lead to the flourishing of the public's will. It leads to tyranny. And so inevitably, the path of human society is Kallipolis, democracy, oligarchy, democracy, and tyranny. And even in Plato's Republic, when his listeners, his audience, his students are interacting with him, and it's in Socrates' voice, their responses are all things like, yes, how could it be otherwise? I could not see how it could possibly be different than this. It's just a ridiculous level of agreement about certainty regarding how actual historical events are bound to unfold. And yet, in truth, those even what seem to be inevitable developments are never actually inevitable. And, even when you find examples, well, look, that's how it happened in France, and that's how it happened in this country, and so on. Even cursory forms that appear to confirm what's going on may include as much confirmation bias as actual evidence. And I could give all kinds of examples of that. I mean, I respect a lot of the birth order stuff that goes on. I find it a very helpful tool when I'm talking to people. That's fine. But I mean, when the birth order edict, if you're a firstborn, you're like this. If you're a middle child, you're like that. And if you're a last child, you're like that. And that's the way it's going to be. And then you say, okay, well, tell me about yourself, and I've seen people do this. So tell me about yourself, and they tell them about themselves, and they say, "Oh, well, you're a firstborn," and they're like, "No, I'm second." Oh, well, then it's because of this exception. It's because of this other, and you can make it work because you can use the exceptions as a way to confirm your bias that your system actually does work. It also doesn't make it useless. It is useful. I'm not saying it's useless, but I am saying, trying to define with certainty the things that actually can have some contingency to them can be misleading. And so anyway, you get the idea that if a person's taking a rationalist approach to problem solving or understanding the world or whatever it is, there are certain implications for that in how they're going to approach life. And one of the implications of that is that things are going to be, and I'm going to use the word centralized because most of us are familiar with that in economic terms, but it is centralized. And I mean by that, that in learning, for instance, we might have an expectation of conformity to a template that we've already created, to a pattern or an understanding we already have or a necessity we believe is absolute. And no matter what evidence we get, we're going to make everything fit that. And then we're going to solve the problem that way. And truth is, it can work. It can work so that we at least get to the next step that we wanted to get to. So I'm not saying one is good, one is bad. I'm saying they are different. And I want to explain why I have realized that I have a preference toward the empirical that I think might be something we should all recognize is useful to us. So I before I say it about empiricism, I just want to affirm that in favor of a rational approach, there are areas where you just have to do that. I do a lot of things from that rational framework. When I'm doing a sermon prep, I have a fixed, rigid pattern that I follow. I work on the context of the text itself, understand the text, understand the things around the text, get the basic meaning out, and then I turn around and look at my context, the culture, based on what I'm reading, how would that apply to this setting, blah, 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 and then I marry those together into the context of what I want to say in a message. You know, when I'm getting a sermon, I have a very fixed pattern, and all of those have very fixed ingredients to them, and the outcome I want, not the one that rigidly, you know, that everything has to fit perfectly, but the outcome I'm always looking for is a form that reflects the text and within each point has some kind of explanation, illustration, and application. All of that's very rationalistic. I need it to fit my template kind of stuff. On personal competence, if I'm looking at a problem, and this primarily is something I learned when I was teaching bioethics all the time, biomedical ethics, that if I'm wanting to comprehend whether a person still has competence to make good decisions on their own or whatever, I know to look at three areas: comprehension, manipulation, and purpose. If they can answer questions that deal with those three things, then we generally say, look, they have enough competence to make their own decision about this. And if they can't, then we say, somebody's going to need to step in and help them. They're not able to think clearly about the world anymore. In a world with as many people as do have Alzheimer's and such like that, you can imagine why that becomes an important question if you're associated with a family or in ministry. You know, it's just going to come up. Or when I'm reading stories, narratives, I have a very rigid, rationalistic look, which didn't come just from a rationalist, but still, for me, is a pattern that I expect to find. And I expect to be able to conform the things I'm doing to this pattern of equilibrium, disruption, recognition, and then the attempt to repair the disruption, and then a new equilibrium. And lo and behold, it works tremendously well. I use it all the time. If I'm talking about heroes or the characters, the primary characters in a story, I know the person I'm looking at's not going to have any enduring relationships, and their personal fulfillment is somehow going to be mitigated or prevented, and that the way they're going to help in the story is not going to be fully understood by the people they're helping. Those are some of the basic characteristics of a hero in a story, and obviously they're messianic characteristics as well. We've done whole episodes on that in the past. I am just saying, I'm not against having some structures that set how we think about things and solve problems, and some of you have those very same things. You know that when you face certain things, you're going to go through three steps, and those are the three steps that you're, and when you're going to approach someone with a certain problem. I'm sure Daisy sitting across the table from me with her behavioral cognitive therapeutic approach to counseling, whatever she calls it, has a list of things she expects to deal with when she's talking to a client. And all of that's fine. It makes perfect sense to me. There is also a disadvantage to having a rigid approach to lists like that or to centralized, organized patterns like that. And that is that the tools that provide a predictable, comprehensive, controlled approach to solving problems, they also can preclude attempts at using other methods, which might fail. To be fair, they might fail. Or might introduce better solutions. And because of that, whatever the solution is that's in a more rationalistic approach like this or centralized approach like this, those are bound to a particular genius. They're bound to a particular mind or a particular time frame. And you can hear the limitations that are going to go with that, because no one mind or no one particular time frame is comprehensive of them all. That's just not good enough to reflect the whole of humanity or human experience, obviously. And so I would say, on the opposite side, in defense instead of empiricism, which I have a preference for in some ways, I think there are some things that we ought to be a little more open to in approaching things in a more empirical way, with a more empiricist mindset is what I mean by that, in a more empirical way in this case. And so I my preference for it, I'm not talking about epistemology. I'm not talking about my preference to believe that human beings begin as a blank slate and that just experience shapes their minds. You know, I obviously am very strongly theologically inclined, and I believe this. I mean, it's not just because my theology dictates it. I do believe it. There are certain structures in our mind I think God creates in us so that we can comprehend the world accurately. And I think that's an important thing for a person to acknowledge. And acknowledging that is the opposite of empiricism. So I'm not an empiricist in the sense that my theory inevitably binds me to it. And that's not what this is about. What I'm talking about is outcomes. You know, in the world where we live and in the place where we're actually looking at problems in the face and trying to figure out what to do with them, any kind of problem. I mean, a problem where you're trying to figure out how to get along with your family, or where you're trying to figure out how to get along with your country, or trying to understand how to get your car started again. You know, whatever it is, that those outcomes could be better shaped if we were more understanding of why I think it is that empiricism and that kind of approach actually does work so well, because it does work well. Economics is the easiest path for me to get there. For maybe my audience, at least most of the people I know who listen and participate in the podcast, and for most of the people I get to influence when I go to churches and things like that, there seems to be an acceptance of this idea in the economic realm, because libertarian approach to economics sort of dictates that you understand it this way. And I mean by that sort of the invisible hand, as we talk about it in economics. A lot of what we understand about the invisible hand is really just supply and demand determining the prices of things. And I've read for you how that's not bound to empiricism in the modern world. I mean, it goes all the way back to Arab values, you know, certain Arab-speaking communities historically over a millennium ago, you know, that this is being expressed anciently, that prices need to be set by supply and demand and not by a person sitting on top saying, well, I think water should cost this much and I think grain should cost that much. That kind of understanding of the invisible hand is actually really helpful, and it's been argued for the last 100 years in the public domain, meaning everybody out in the marketplace has probably heard of the invisible hand, even if you haven't really thought about it. And what it really amounts to, the invisible hand, is more than just supply and demand determining prices. It's this really, and if you go beyond economics, it certainly is, but even in economics, it's this really complex relationship of, and this is just me, I put it this way, I'm not quoting someone, of psychological and relational and social, emotional, structural, behavioral impetuses and influences and systems that have too many variables and variations for us to precisely predict and much less control what they're going to do. And if you think to yourself, well, I don't think that's the case at all. We can control our markets. I mean, after all, don't we have three people sitting on top of the world controlling what's going on with all the markets all the time? Obviously, I'm saying no. That's just not possible to do. And the reason it's not possible to do is the same reason that financial markets inherently involve speculation and uncertainty. If they didn't, everybody would get wealthy at the same moment. That one's the one that's going to go up. And it just doesn't work that way. You can manipulate things for a temporary spike in a value of something and so on, but you can't keep it there. And that's why markets are what they are and always and inevitably involve speculation and uncertainty, because we can't see the invisible hand. Again, not, you don't have to jump back now and go, oh, the invisible hand is obviously God's hand controlling the economy. I'm not against someone saying that, and I certainly believe God is in control of all things. But our point for observation is that it's an invisible hand because the influences that are in it are so complex, so varied, so numerable, that it would be absurd to think that somebody could grasp all of that and do something with it. Even with AI, using all of the data inputs we can possibly imagine, we're still not going to be able to predict whether a snowflake's going to fall on that branch or that branch, or whether snow is even going to fall in October, in wherever, and so on. You get the idea. We just have too many limitations. So that invisible hand could be expanded, you can see, beyond the conversation about economics. And we do have to be realistic about this. I'm inclined as a libertarian. You know, I reveal that all the time. It's part of just being honest about my biases. And I think it's a good bias. I prefer it, obviously. I've chosen it. But I am realistic about this, including the invisible hand. There are impedances to the invisible hand's work. Information can be delayed or unavailable so that the price isn't right because people don't realize there's a lot more supply than we thought there was, or there's a lot less demand than we anticipated, or whatever. There can be a dearth of information. It's also possible to have radical inputs outside what was predictable or expected that can skew the outcome of otherwise of those invisible forces. You know, a war can break out, or disasters can emerge suddenly, or, you know, whatever it is. But that doesn't mean we have to abandon the value of the controlled, uncontrolled forces. And that's my point, that they're uncontrolled forces. They're just doing what they do because of the complexity of the interrelationships between all of these elements in reality that are at work. And so, and when we do intervene and try to control those circumstances, that invisible hand or whatever, and again, I'm admitting sometimes it's necessary. In a hurricane, you don't need people price gouging to take advantage of the victims of a huge disaster. I get that. So you intervene and you make a rule, and we're not going to allow you to do that. And we can explain that away and make it sound like it's part of the invisible hand, or that it's truly promoting libertarian values or whatever. But it's a disruption of that libertarian sort of approach to economics. And so when we do try to control it, even because it's necessary sometimes, there can also be a problem. And that is because it's so complex. If the reason we can't control all of those underlying influences that are constantly bringing about the current state of affairs and then the one that's going to follow, if we can't control it because it's so complex, then very often when we try to control it, what we'll do is just simplify it. Well, actually, let's just get it down to three basic principles, and now I think we can make it work the way we want it to work. And if you read Marxist literature or listen to Marxist thinkers, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory sense. I'm not trying to mock Marxist thinkers. I don't agree with them. I adamantly disagree with them for a bunch of reasons, that I'm not a determinist and I don't like trying to handcuff the invisible hand and so on. So I have a bajillion reasons not to be a Marxist, but I'm not just mocking them. When you read or listen to a Marxist thinker talk about an economy, you realize that a huge portion of what's happened in Marxist literature, and thank you, Hannah Arendt, for clarifying this for me, by the way, I've done whole episodes on this topic, is reducing the complexity of laboring to produce, which is what human beings do, but we also work in order to create, and we also act in order to influence. You eliminate all of that down to nothing more than producing. Well, we got to have these producers, and we got to have that many, and then they can put out the food, and then whatever other things people want to do, they can do. But all that matters to us is we're going to control the means of production, and we're going to control how it, you know, and so on. When you try to reduce the complexity of a system to something like that, you miss the biggest influences in the system. And so you end up creating a lot more problems than you solve, which is, and I'll say it again later, but that is a huge portion of what made the American experiment so valuable, that we didn't simplify it that way, that we actually did entrust to an enormous amount of risk. That's why it's called the American, part of why it's called the American experiment, to an enormous amount of risk, this confidence that if we just let people do their thing, we might prosper. You know, things might turn out pretty well. So simplifying a problem by neglecting its complexities doesn't solve the problem. And so, again, part of the beauty of the American experiment is that we did allow the uncontrollable variety of human interests and abilities to propel the whole system forward into, you know, we knew not what at the time. But look at what it was, this incredible amount of economic success. And I'm only talking from the economic side right now. I'm about to shift out of that in a moment. So you get the idea. And it may have sounded like, well, that was a crazy risk, you know, but in truth, it's a risk with, and this is the point of the discussion today, it's a risk that has more guardrails to it than a singular centralized control could have provided on its own. Yeah, there's risk, but the guardrails that are invisible to us are there. The psychological, social, relational, emotional, systemic, structural guardrails that are there all along. And some of those guardrails are good. Some of them are bad. We want to maintain systems. Systems maintain themselves. I've done whole episodes on how systems maintain themselves. They have this orthopedic structure to them that's not going to give in. Those systems are sometimes bad and sometimes good, but they are guardrails that protect the way a society is functioning, even when we think everything else is out of control. My point, though, isn't about economics. It's about, you know, how we solve problems in general. So, Criswell College has this graduate profile. What do we want our graduates to be like? And one of the characteristics is problem solvers who think critically, creatively, and collaboratively. And all three of those are important. Thinking critically, you could do by yourself. Thinking creatively, you could do by yourself. But when you think collaboratively, if you do it well, if you don't do it well, collaboration can stifle creativity. Well, you're not going to throw out ideas that aren't going to be accepted by the group. And so you really limit even your own creative ideas to things you think are already in, we would say as a society, the Overton window. But that's not the great point of collaboration. The great point of collaboration is when you can just throw out anything against the wall and everybody is seeing what sticks, not just to your wall, but to their wall. And then they're creating more things from it and all that kind of stuff. You can come up with ideas you never would have come up with otherwise. If you apply it, for instance, to ethics and solving the problem of what you're going to do in a certain situation to be right, and again, to remind you, I have an absolute approach to ethics. Kantian ethics is my approach, and that absolute approach means the categorical imperative. Act only on that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that everyone should do what you're about to do. I'm in favor of the categorical imperative in whatever form you put it. I can put it in all three forms, but we don't want to go down that road right now. Anyway, the point is, and that's very top down. I mean, the answers to the categorical imperative are all absolute. Lying is always wrong. Truth is always best. There is no question. Suicide is always wrong. The answers are absolute, crystal clear. But I also know that that kind of top down controlled response to real and complex ethical issues is artificial and stifling and shallow and can get things wrong. Any of us can give a controlled answer to a morally simple question. Should you disobey authority? Of course not. That's why it's authority. I mean, that's the point. That's clear in scripture. You're not supposed to be the person who is upending authority. All right, fine. Nice and crystal clear. The challenge is the morally complex question. We all know this question. Should you betray your Jewish friend in order to obey the Nazi authority? They are an authority, after all. Now you got a moral dilemma, and it's more than moral. It's a relational dilemma, a social one, a psychological one, a familial one, a religious one, a cultural one. There are influences coming from every direction in that moment. You're staring at the Nazi guard saying, what do I do? Do I tell them the truth and betray all my commitments? Do I, you know, I somehow recognize their authority, which I think is illegitimate to begin with, and blah, blah, blah. You're trying to answer a really complex question in that moment. And if Immanuel Kant suddenly appeared next to you and said, don't be an idiot, lying's wrong, just tell the truth, it's done. He would be ignoring the complexity of that real situation, because you also made a commitment to the Jewish friend you let hide in your closet, you know, to use the paradigmatic example that people use. Look, all you have to do is look at social media. Just please don't, by the way. But social media judgments are little more than one-dimensional and naive cartoonish caricatures of what should be seen as genuinely complex realities. Just read them. The ones that make you the angriest, the ones that you read and think, oh man, I can't believe they said that. Or the ones that make you clap and go, finally, someone said what needed to be said. They are that. They're just these one-dimensional, naive, cartoonish caricatures. They solve the problem spit spot. You clap the dust off your hands and see, I mean, that was easy. No, there was no real problem there. See, that whole Arminian Calvinist thing, it's simple. I mean, whosoever will, there's no problem at all. Or, well, God's will cannot be thwarted. You see, there's no problem at all. Spit spot solution. You know, it's all taken care of. That kind of simplification wouldn't be there if we were willing to back up and go, man, I got more inputs coming than I can possibly keep hold of. And I've got more outcomes to consider than I've probably considered yet. So let's get a whole lot of input and give it a whole lot of consideration. And then let's make the best decision we can about what we ought to do. It's in the way we teach liberal arts. Again, we have a gen ed program. We've got all the stuff that makes us value higher education. And by the way, I'll just make this point. I don't take an empiricist, this kind of empiricist approach I'm talking about today. When I'm teaching my logic class, it's logic class. It's very similar to what you would do in a math class. You just have a certain list of things you need to learn. You need to understand what the terms are that we're talking about with propositions and propositional subjects and predicates, and then what it means in an argument for a thing to be the subject and the predicate, and what you're doing with all those copula that are in there, and whether it's an affirmation or negation. I've got a certain list of things people need to learn, and how do you evaluate a syllogism, and how many terms is it supposed to have, and how many times are they used, and what do you do if you have two, you know what, you get the idea. In logic, I'm not taking that approach. But in higher ed in general, I mean, our goal isn't just to teach students to regurgitate information. Well, if you'll memorize these 12 lists, you'll be good to go for life. We want to teach students to think. That's the whole point. And if that seems too insecure, then just think for a second about how God transmitted his truth in our own faith, in our own Christian faith. How do we believe God transmitted his truth? And if you take it in the form of Scripture, as I do, that's the basis of our authority. Open the Scriptures. It's not a single list of rules and doctrines. And this is God looking at humanity. Have you looked at humanity lately? We're not good at reading and interpreting things. We're not great at it. God looks at humanity and then decides how he's going to convey the truth. And he doesn't say, let's give them a list of rules and doctrines. No, no, no. One list wouldn't do. Let's give them 12 lists of rules and doctrines and then get them to memorize that. And then everything will be. He doesn't do any of that. He creates this mishmash compilation of poetry. And each one of these, by the way, has barriers to it between the text and the person who's reading it that all of us know, because sometimes we have a hard time reading it. It's a mishmash, this compilation of poetry and history and wisdom and apocalyptic literature and then letters and visions and, most of all, stories, most of which themselves don't have a single prescriptive element on the face of them. You don't get to the end of the story and say, and this is the lesson that you were supposed to learn. Sometimes they have that, but most of the time they just don't. And all of those things are coming from different, very often unknown authors in different cultures and in different languages, not just from ours, but from each other. So, God gives us this. And obviously he's not doing it so that, well, I just want people to come up with their own truths. I want them to discover their own religion. that's not the point of a divine revelation in anybody's understanding in Christianity that I know. Then, why would he leave it so open-ended? I don't think it's difficult to understand this. Different people with different expertise push us into communities. Because if I'm not great at reading poetry, but I need to understand the Psalms in order to understand the Revelation, then I need somebody who's good at reading poetry to help me do it. And whether it's in an educational setting or a church setting or a discipleship setting, one-on-one or in little groups or classes, I'm starting to meet together and be disciplined and learn these things and memorize them, not just so I can regurgitate them, but so that I can apply them, and I'm applying them in different ways because different experts have an understanding of blah, blah, blah. It pushes us into a community. Where instead of just saying, oh, I get everything because I've memorized all 1,189 chapters of the Bible, I instead sit down with a whole group of people. And, you know, this is the stuff that I've read about it. Have you all read other things about it? What part of the text is your favorite? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. The other part of it that I think is critical to why God would leave it so open-ended is because different cultures with completely different social, economic, political, personal, and even familial issues exist over the course of human history. And for us to think you just reduce that to a list of 12 things and this is what makes your society whole would be for us, well, fundamentally, to be looking at God and saying, we don't think you did it the best way in the Bible. So I'm suggesting to you that open-ended nature may not be a terrible thing. Okay, so what's all this supposed to mean? What I was trying to get at was, you know, I put it in three categories of points that I'm trying to make. First category is the stuff that's just about the fact that we're not perfect. So unless you are perfect, you need some things to escape your control and shape you in ways you didn't expect. I want to give so many little examples of how this is the case that, all of us know people who have their lives so rigidly fixed and their way of doing things so rigidly fixed, they can't think of anything outside of the little circle they're in. I would never fit in that category myself, of course. I'm saying that sarcastically in case you can't tell. The reality is all of us, because we're not perfect, need some things to escape our control and shape us in ways we didn't plan or expect. And also, unless you're perfect, the people you have influence over, whether it's formal influence, like you're their boss, or informal influence because you're their friend, the people you have influence over may need you to have less than complete control over whatever it is you're exerting over them. That is, they may need better than your solution to things. They may need your input and your willingness to accept that the way they solve the problem may be different than the way you solve the problem. And it may not even be something you fully understand. That's okay. We need to accept that that could be a reality because we're not perfect. Second category, that when we're ourselves facing risk, this is when we're trying to solve a problem. You know, something's gone wrong, something's out of control, we're nervous about it, we have anxiety, whatever it is. When you're in a risky environment, remember that your control of that environment is not the only thing providing control. You don't create all the guardrails for your experience, your existence. You live in a world full of these controlling forces that you never see. Some of them are in your own mind. Some psychological forces are controlling you. You don't even understand yourself. We understand that from Jeremiah 17. We quote that passage all the time. But beyond that, the sociological forces and the systems that are at work and the familial pressures and all those kinds of things that are present there, those are also guardrails that kind of help keep the risk from getting out of control. And it can help to alleviate some of our anxiety if we recognize that. A couple of different ways you can apply that. First, have some faith that God might know what he's doing even when you don't. If you want to say it in Christian terms, that's the very direct meaning of this. Have some faith. God may know what he's doing when you don't. He may have guardrails up that you don't see. Secondly, a different way of looking at it, remember that a whole complex reality of systems and structures, individuals and communities and interests and skills and proclivities and reactions, they've been involved in shaping the way our lives go for thousands of years now, and that they're not all likely simply to vanish or cease to function in this moment when you're not figuring out how to get control of something. So when you're in a risky environment, you know, keep in mind, it's okay that some of the solutions that are going to come are more complex than you can grasp. And when you're in charge, the last thing I'll say, when you are in charge, leave room for better things to happen than what you yourself have planned. I mean, that's the crux in Paul's prayer for the Ephesians. His prayer for the Ephesians is to the one who is able to do exceeding abundantly and above all that we, in our controlling way, ask or think.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.